The Eight Immortals Travel East, Chapter 45.
The text introduces the Queen Mother of the West, also referred to as Wangmu or Long Tang Jinmu, and the way her origins are described establishes an immediate, just deeply complex paradox.
It really does.
How exactly does the source text frame her existence at the very beginning? I mean, it's pretty abstract.
It is. The text begins by anchoring her in these abstract cosmological phenomena. It literally states, she is born of the sublime breath of West Heaven in Yishuan.
The sublime breath.
Right. And in the context of ancient Chinese cosmology, breath or kray is not simply air.
No, it's way more fundamental than that.
Exactly. It is the vital, formative energy of the universe. So to be born of the sublime breath of West Heaven means she is not just some deity residing in a specific location.
Right. She's not just a person who lives in the West.
No, she is the literal anthropomorphized manifestation of the Western directional essence of the universe itself.
Wow.
She is the transition point from the formless void into structured reality.
So she is essentially a foundational law of physics given form.
That's a great way to put it.
It sounds infinite and just entirely formless. But then almost immediately, the author grounds this infinite cosmic force with an incredibly specific bureaucratic identity.
Yes. It's such a jarring pivot.
It really is. I mean, the text provides her with a very human framework. It dictates her surname as Ho, her given name is Hui, and her courtesy names as Wanjin and Taisu.
Which is so hyperspecific. In classical Chinese society, a surname and courtesy names are the absolute hallmarks of social hierarchy, lineage, and bureaucratic integration.
I am just so fascinated by this contradiction.
Yes, so.
Well, on one hand, the text explicitly details that she partners with the Duke of the East Dong Wang Gong to manage the two vital energies, yin and yang.
Right, the foundational forces.
Yeah, if we think about this in terms of like systems engineering, yin and yang are the binary code of reality. They are the foundational mechanisms shaping heaven and earth.
So she is operating at the absolute base layer of cosmic reality.
Exactly. She holds a very specific managerial title over a very specific demographic.
Right. The text says she rules over all female immortals.
Okay, let's unpack this. She is the ultimate head of human resources for all female immortals.
That is essentially what she is, yes. She holds supreme dominion over anyone who achieves immortality as a female, whether they ascend from Earth or are just native to the heavenly realms.
She is the ultimate administrator for that specific metaphysical constituency.
Yes.
So the question is, why the dual identity? Why does a text dealing with the sublime breath of the universe bother to establish a surname and a specific human resources portfolio?
It's a really good question.
Right. Like, if you are managing the thermodynamic balance of yin and yang, why do you need the administrative title?
I think it speaks to the mechanics of how human beings conceptualize the infinite.
Okay, say more about that.
Well, an entirely abstract universe operating purely on formless energies is philosophically terrifying.
Yeah, it's just too big to grasp.
Exactly. It is too vast, too uncaring. So by filtering that infinite cosmic force through the lens of a highly structured bureaucratic identity, the author renders the divine comprehensible to the reader.
I see. It creates a localized gravitational force that the human mind can actually observe. It is the difference between trying to comprehend the sheer scale of a black hole versus interacting with the physicist who calculates its mass.
That is an excellent analogy. The bureaucracy implies accountability. It suggests that the universe, at its absolute highest echelons, is not just random chaos.
Right, there's a manager.
There's a manager.
Yes.
It is governed by individuals who have domains, portfolios, and even courtesy names that reflect your status. Wanjin and Taisu aren't just names.
What are they then?
They are signifiers that she holds the highest possible aristocratic rank in a cosmology that inherently values ordered hierarchy.
Okay, so it establishes that order is the absolute baseline of the universe.
Yes.
And if order is the baseline, then the environment where the Queen Mother resides must be the ultimate physical manifestation of that order.
And it absolutely is. The text moves from her origins to her real estate, and the descriptions of her domain are just staggering.
Yeah, let's talk about her real estate. Where exactly does the author place her residence?
In the Kunlun Mountains, specifically within the Langfeng Garden.
Langfeng Garden.
Right. And it details the Jade Tower, which is a 9-tier terrace flanked by the Jade Pool Yaoqi on the left and Emerald Water on the right.
A 9-tier terrace flanked by perfectly curated celestial waters.
It's architectural supremacy.
It really is. And the text doesn't just describe the buildings, right? It populates this space. We are introduced to her five daughters.
Yes, and we're given their specific names.
Right, Huailin, Maixian, King, Yaoji, and Wang Hu.
Now, listing the names of her daughters serves a really vital narrative function here.
Really? Why is that?
Because it anchors the infinite cosmic principle into a familial dynastic structure. It reinforces her role not just as a manager, but as the ultimate matriarch, presiding over an impenetrable inherited domain.
Impenetrable is definitely the key word there. Because before we even get to the main event of the banquet, the text provides this extensive historical precedent to demonstrate just how exclusive this space is.
Oh, the historical visitors, yes.
Right. It details the extremely rare instances where mortals have interacted with her. So let's look at the first historical visitor mentioned, King Mu of Zhu.
Right, King Mu. He represents the absolute apex of mortal power and ambition.
He's as big as it gets on Earth.
Exactly. The text notes that he rides his 8 magnificent horses on a Western inspection tour, which is essentially him projecting his imperial authority as far as the physical geography of the Earth allows.
And he actually reaches her domain.
He does, and he presents her with the highest status items the mortal world possesses.
White jade and dark jewels.
Right. And for this, he is granted the immense privilege of drinking with her at the jade pool.
But the interaction itself is incredibly chilling. I mean, she doesn't embrace him. She responds to his gifts with a poem.
A very specific poem.
Yeah, and the essence of that poem is just a stark delineation of boundaries. She describes the endless white clouds, the emerging mountains, the massive distances separating them.
And then she hits him with the ending.
Right. She ends it with the line, if you don't die, maybe you can come back.
If you don't die.
That is brutal.
It is a devastating reminder of the mechanical limitation of his existence. King Mu arrives, operating under this illusion that his imperial mortal power holds currency in the divine realm.
He brings jade, assuming she values what he values.
Exactly.
I want to dissect that moment because I think it perfectly highlights the thermodynamics of immortality.
Oh, I like that phrasing.
Think about it. King Mu is expending massive amounts of energy, resources, and time to reach her. He is fighting the entropy of his own mortal life.
Right.
And she sits there, entirely outside the flow of time, essentially telling him that his effort is meaningless because his biology has a hard stop.
Mm.
It's a profound dismissal of his entire worldview.
She is defining the boundary. No matter how much jade a mortal king hoards, he is still fundamentally subject to decay.
Right.
And this theme of mortals failing to comprehend the mechanics of the divine is escalated significantly with the text's second historical visitor,
Emperor Wu of Han. And this interaction is where the text introduces the central mechanism of the entire narrative, the magical peaches.
Yes, the peaches. So the Queen Mother actually descends to Emperor Wu's palace, and she gifts him 7 of these peaches.
But the text provides a crucial biological timeline for this fruit.
It does. They take 3,000 years to bear fruit.
3,000 years? Just to get one harvest?
Yeah, exactly. One harvest every 3 millennia.
That is just, I mean, it completely breaks your brain when you try to actually picture it. It requires a complete reorientation of how we perceive time.
It's totally alien to human experience.
And Emperor Wu's reaction perfectly encapsulates mortal hubris.
Oh, absolutely.
He eats 2 of them, and then he deliberately keeps the pits. He wants to plant them.
He attempts to domesticate the divine.
Exactly.
He attempts to extract the mechanism of immortality and bring it under his own sovereign control.
It is such a brilliant, recognizable psychological flaw. It is the equivalent of a human witnessing a star going supernova, and their immediate instinct is to try and scoop the light into a glass jar so they can use it to power a lamp in their living room.
That is hilarious, but it's totally accurate.
It just shows a fundamental lack of understanding of the scale and the conditions required to produce the phenomena.
And the Queen Mother's response is swift and absolute. She tells him directly that the peach is not something the mortal world can possess.
Because the earthly soil lacks the metaphysical resonance required to sustain it.
Right. But she doesn't stop at merely correcting his botanical misunderstanding. She actively undermines his authority right there in his own palace.
And this is the moment that completely recontextualizes the divine hierarchy for me.
The spy.
Yes. She points to a man hiding in the room, a spy named Dongfang Shuo. And she says, my peaches have ripened 3 times, and this kid has already stolen them 2.
It's an incredible reveal. Let us just calculate the sheer scale of that statement based on the text's parameters.
Please do.
If the peaches require 3,000 years to ripen, and and this is the third ripening, she is referring to a 9,000-year cultivation cycle.
9,000 years.
Right. And for Domfang Shuo to have stolen them twice before, he has been successfully infiltrating the Kunlun Mountains, the most heavily fortified, exclusive divine reality in existence, for thousands of years.
This raises a massive structural question about the Queen Mother's domain.
What's the question?
Well, if she is the supreme manager of reality, and her garden is perfectly ordered, how does the thief even exist? I mean, is she simply allowing him to steal them? Why point out this specific trickster to Emperor Wu, other than to just embarrass him?
That's the crux of it. She's demonstrating that the rules governing the cosmos are not identical to the rules governing mortal empires.
Okay, break that down for me.
Emperor Wu relies on absolute control, rigid borders, and martial authority. He assumes the heavens operate the exact same way.
Right.
But by pointing out Dongfang Shuo, the Queen Mother is revealing that the divine realm has room for the trickster archetype. Dongfang Shuo isn't hoarding the peaches or trying to plant the pits to build an empire.
He's just snagging a snack every few millennia.
Exactly. He exists in the margins, subverting the system through wit rather than force. The Queen Mother tolerates the trickster because the trickster understands the nature of the divine better than the emperor does.
The emperor wants to own the magic, while the trickster just wants to experience it.
Exactly.
It completely shatters the emperor's illusion of control. And this entire historical prologue with King Mu and Emperor Wu serves one specific narrative purpose.
To establish an impossibly high bar.
Right. If powerful emperors are dismissed and mocked, what kind of entity could possibly impress the Queen Mother?
Which brings us to the present timeline of the text.
The main event.
The Peach Banquet itself. And the guest list is a staggering assembly of cosmic authority. You've got Buddhas, the Jade Emperor, an array of gods and immortals.
It is the absolute zenith of the celestial hierarchy.
It really is. And because it is the Queen Mother's birthday, the text focuses heavily on the exchange of gifts.
But it notes something very specific about the offerings from the General Assembly of Gods.
Yes, the generic gifts.
It states that they present flags and tents, and that these items are completely uninspiring to the Queen Mother.
And from a metaphysical standpoint, why would she care about flags and tents?
I mean, they sound like corporate swag.
They basically are. Those are symbols of territorial conquest and temporary shelter. Those are concepts that only matter to beings bound by geography and vulnerability.
Right. She manages the fabric of yin and yang. She doesn't need a tent.
Exactly. The generic gods are offering gifts that project their own perceived status rather than considering the reality of the recipient.
They are trapped in their own paradigm of value. It would be like offering a master architect, I don't know, a mass-produced plastic building block.
Yes. It completely misses the point of who they are and what they actually comprehend.
But then, the primary guests of our narrative arrive.
The eight immortals.
And their approach to gift-giving fundamentally alters the entire dynamic of the banquet.
It's a total paradigm shift. They present a cloud scroll. And the text provides a very sensory and spatial description of this object.
It says it radiates brilliant light, resembling clouds and the sunset glow, right?
Yes, and it is inscribed with profound, lingering words.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me.
Where?
The crucial detail, the mechanism that actually turns the key in the lock for the Queen Mother, is spatial.
Yes, the dimensions.
The text explicitly notes that when the scroll is unrolled, its size fits the hall perfectly without exceeding by a single inch.
That exact phrasing, fitting perfectly without exceeding by an inch, is the most vital piece of data in this entire section.
Why is that the vital part?
Because the brilliance of the light and the profundity of the words are impressive, sure, but they are expected in a heavenly realm. The spatial perfection is what elevates the gift from a standard tribute to a masterstroke of cosmic empathy.
How does fitting the room equate to empathy?
Think about the architectural philosophy here.
Okay, let's dig into that. The eight immortals presumably don't live in this hall. Yet they manage to calculate or intuit the exact volume and dimensions of the space.
Right.
In a room full of deities who are essentially just shouting their own importance through generic gifts, the eight immortals created an object that actually listens to the room.
It is an act of supreme mindfulness.
Yeah.
You know, in Taoist philosophy, space is not merely empty. It is the active container of reality. The usefulness of a bowl is in its empty space.
Right, the void.
Yes. So by bringing a scroll that flawlessly integrates into the exact dimensions of her hall, the immortals are demonstrating an understanding of her environment, They are honoring the void she has created rather than just trying to fill it with their own ego.
It's a physical manifestation of resonance.
Oh, I like that.
When an acoustic wave perfectly matches the dimensions of a room, it creates a standing wave, a perfect continuous vibration without any destructive interference. The eight immortals achieved spatial resonance.
They really did.
They didn't just bring a beautiful object. They brought harmony to her specific architecture.
And the Queen Mother immediately recognizes this profound level of attention. The text notes her deep delight.
Because they demonstrated that they truly see her environment, she rewards them by granting them deeper access to it.
Right. She orders her attendants to open her private Langfang garden for them to tour.
And this garden tour is where the text just explodes into surreal metaphysical world building.
It's gorgeous.
It is a VIP pass to the inner workings of the universe. The immortals are shown strange exotic flowers, dancing spiritual beasts, and bluebirds that gather around them.
The author is mapping out an ecosystem that is entirely divorced from mortal biology. The beasts dance, the birds sing in complex harmony. Nature here is not engaged in a brutal struggle for survival.
No, it's engaged in perpetual aesthetic expression.
Exactly.
But the most jarring detail of the garden tour relates to the landscape itself. They walk up these twisting 9-tier terraces, looking out over landscapes where the text explicitly states, jade is planted.
Yes, the jade fields.
It even quotes a poem noting that there are fields all planted with jade. Let's stop and examine the mechanics of that for a second.
Okay.
Jade is a mineral. In the mortal world, it requires immense geological pressure, deep time, and brutal human labor to mine, carve, and polish.
It is the ultimate symbol of rigid, hard-won value in ancient Chinese culture.
Exactly. But here, in the Queen Mother's garden, jade grows from the soil like wheat. What does that do to the metaphysical economy of the universe?
It fundamentally inverts it.
Right.
Think about it. If the hardest, most valuable mineral in the mortal realm grows effortlessly like grass in the divine realm, it renders the mortal pursuit of wealth totally absurd.
It makes King Mu look like a fool.
Exactly. He brought her carved jade as a tribute, completely unaware that she uses it as landscaping.
Wow.
By showing the immortals these fields, she is allowing them to perceive the infinite abundance of the cosmos. It is a visual confirmation that the limitations and scarcities that define mortal suffering simply do not exist here.
The immortals are fully absorbing this mind-bending reality, and then they return to the jade pool for the actual banquet feast.
Dinner is served.
And this is where the central conflict of the text crystallizes. We move from the architecture of the space to the behavior within it.
Right. The feast is laid out. And the text lists jiao pears, fire dates, jade liquid, kuang syrup, sesame, and purple mushrooms.
It is a menu of absolute metaphysical refinement.
It is, but the narrative quickly pivots from the food to the entertainment.
The Queen Mother wishes to honor the immortals, so she orders her personal maids to perform.
And the author inserts a fascinating temporal detail here.
The timeline again.
Yes. The Queen Mother explicitly states that these maids have not played their instruments since Emperor Wu's visit.
Okay, wait. We established earlier that Emperor Wu's timeline was separated by potentially millennia from the current events, given the cycles of the 3,000-year peaches.
Exactly.
If these maids have not performed since then, their music is not a regular occurrence.
No, it is an artifact. It is an event of supreme rarity and extreme formality. The text even notes her command to the maids, "You must not disobey."
It is a performance mandated by absolute authority. And the text identifies the specific musicians and their instruments, too.
It does. Dong Shuangcheng plays the flute. Wang Zedeng plays the ao, which is a complex stringed instrument. Xu Fei Kuang plays the huang, a reed pipe. And An Faki sings the song Miaochu.
Let's talk about the mechanics of this ensemble.
These instruments represent the absolute height of classical mathematical precision. The ao requires exact tension on the strings to produce perfect Pythagorean intervals.
Right.
The huang requires precise breath control to vibrate the reed at exact frequencies. The text describes their performance as the broad music of the highest heaven, with high and low pitches intertwining in flawless harmony.
It is the acoustic manifestation of the Queen Mother herself.
Yes.
It is ancient, mathematically perfect, entirely structured, and completely devoid of spontaneous variation. It is an orchestra that only plays when the universe demands it.
And the text notes that the immortals feel refreshed and uplifted by it. It is objectively beautiful.
But absolute perfection is, by its very nature, static.
Exactly. And Taoism, which is the philosophical undercurrent of this entire text, warns against systems that become too static.
Because they freeze.
Right. A system without movement, even a perfect one, eventually stagnates. The perfection of the heavenly court is heavy. It requires an immense amount of energy to maintain that flawless rigidity.
Which perfectly sets the stage for Long Kai.
Oh, Long Kai.
Long Kai is one of the eight immortals, and he completely shatters this static perfection. He steps up, holds his cup, and the Queen Mother specifically requests that he perform his treading song.
And Long Kai initially hesitates, right? He acknowledges the vast gap in decorum. He notes that after her magnificent classical music, the spring snow, his simple earthly song might be jarring to listen to.
He is fully aware of the context he's about to violate.
Yes.
But she insists. Yeah. And the description of his performance is a masterclass in kinetic contrast.
It's wild.
It really is. While the maid sat perfectly still, plucking strings with mathematical precision, Lan Kai He turns the courtyard into a stage for physical chaos. He hikes up his robes. He's bending down, leaning back. The text says he moves slowly and then suddenly jumps.
He's stomping heavily, clicking his large wooden clappers together, and he shouts out a lyric, Jing Bi Ju.
Which loosely translates to, the scenery is completely exhausted, or everything is fully present here.
That
is a total sensory assault on the most formal room in the universe. Everyone bursts out laughing. I want to explore the psychological mechanism of why this works.
Okay.
Lan Kai He is essentially injecting raw, unrefined thermodynamic energy, heat, movement, noise into a perfectly chilled, frictionless environment. Why doesn't the Queen Mother, the architect of that perfect order, immediately expel him?
Because true cosmic balance requires both.
Yin and yang.
Exactly. The Queen Mother manages yin and yang. But her court has become overwhelmingly dominated by the passive, structured, ancient energy of yin. Her maids haven't played in centuries. The environment is practically frozen in its own majesty.
So she needs a spark.
Yes. Lan Kai He brings pure, explosive yang. He brings the physical reality of the present moment, sweat, gravity, spontaneous muscle movement.
He reminds the room that existence isn't just about flawless mathematical harmony. It is also about the messy, unpredictable joy of simply moving a body through space.
Exactly. And the text confirms this interpretation through the Queen Mother's reaction.
She loves it.
She does. She does not punish him. She declares, this is something my theatrical ministers have never achieved.
Because her own ministers are trapped in the mandate of perfection. They can never surprise her.
Right. Lan Kai He surprised her. She rewards him by having a massive cup of wine poured for him.
She is essentially acknowledging that the ultimate luxury for someone who controls everything is to experience something they didn't script.
It is an incredible shift in power dynamics. The immortals aren't submitting to her rules. They are providing the necessary counterbalance to her environment.
And this dynamic is synthesized beautifully by the next performer.
Han Qiangzi.
Right. The crowd urges Han Qiangzi to play a Taoist song. He steps out, plays his flute, and sings. The author describes the notes and lyrics as completely extraordinary, soaring into the clouds.
But the critical mechanism here is how his music functions compared to the maids and Lan Kai He.
Right. The maids were pure, rigid structure. Lan Kai He was pure, chaotic energy. What is Han Jiangzi doing with his flute?
The Queen Mother's reaction gives us the answer. She says, this song perfectly mimics immortal scenery.
Ah.
Han Jiangzi has taken the spontaneous, authentic energy of Lan Kai He and filtered it through a high level of artistic mastery, creating something that resonates with the divine environment. He synthesizes the chaos and the order.
He bridges the gap. And the validation he receives is the ultimate triumph of the text.
The Queen Mother turns to her own lead singer, Anfaki, the vocalist who just delivered the flawless classical performance, and orders her to memorize and copy Han Jiangzi's spontaneous Taoist song.
It is the establishment recognizing the superiority of the vanguard. The ancient, unchangeable heavens are suddenly rewriting their sheet music based on the spontaneous improvisation of a Taoist immortal.
It proves that true immortality isn't static preservation. It is the capacity for continuous, authentic adaptation.
The eight immortals have entirely won the room. They brought a perfectly measured gift that showed they understood the rules, and then they broke those rules with such authentic joy that the host changed her own protocol.
It is a total victory.
But as the text brilliantly illustrates, When you completely win over the host of the universe, and she keeps pouring you massive cups of celestial wine, the situation is bound to destabilize.
Oh, inevitably. We reach the climax of the banquet. The ultimate reward is served. The peaches.
The 3,000-year peaches.
Right. The Queen Mother presents two of these peaches to each of the immortals. And during this consumption, her five daughters are continuously serving wine.
And the author is very clear about the biological state of the immortals at this point.
Very clear.
The text states they were overjoyed, their spirits were soaring, and from the continuous drinking, they unknowingly became deeply intoxicated. They are entirely hammered on the most potent vintage in the cosmos.
And this intoxication strips away any remaining veneer of celestial formality, leaving us with a deeply recognizable study of group psychology.
It really does. It's so relatable. The oldest immortal, Zhong Guolao, attempts to reassert some structure. He takes the lead, thanks the Queen Mother, and initiates their departure.
And the five daughters formally escort them out of the garden and into the clouds.
This transition is visually and philosophically crucial. Yeah. They're leaving the Langfang Garden. They're stepping out of the most manicured, protected, curated space in existence.
And as they stand on the clouds looking down, they're confronted with the absolute opposite of the garden.
The east.
Yes. The text describes it as having white waves surging to the sky, wind and water crashing violently against the shore, a vast, boundless expanse without any edge.
The garden is a space of absolute definition. The East Sea is a space of total dissolution. It is the primordial chaos. It has no borders, no geometry, no architecture.
And staring into that chaotic void, while heavily intoxicated, triggers a cascade of group decision-making that is flawlessly mapped onto human behavior.
Lu Dongbin, acting as a group's instigator, looks at this terrifying ocean and essentially says, I hear there are cool mirages out there. We're in a great mood. Why don't we go explore it?
Dongbin represents the psychological archetype of the eternal seeker. He's agitated by boundaries. The garden was a boundary. He wants to cross the next one.
Then you have Iron Crutch Lai, who immediately agrees. He represents the agreeable participant, the person swept up in the momentum of the instigator's energy.
But then the friction occurs. Zhong Guolao pushes back.
Because he's the oldest.
Right. Zhong Guolao is the voice of grounded reality. He points out the obvious limiting factor. We are drunk today. We should wait and go another day. He is advocating for a return to safety, a return to order.
This is a debate occurring on every street corner at 2 a.m. Half the group wants to leap into the unknown, and the other half wants to go to sleep.
Exactly. And how does the text resolve this gridlock? It introduces the rationalizer.
Zhong Liquan.
Right. Zhong Liquan steps in to bridge the gap. He provides the logical scaffolding for an illogical desire. He argues that the specific conditions of the present moment, their collective presence and their heightened mood, are rare and valuable.
He explicitly says, it's hard to get everyone together, hard to get in the mood.
Which is so true.
But then he deploys a brilliant piece of logistical maneuvering. He brings up a future obligation. The Longwa Assembly. He says, the Longwa Assembly is coming up. Let's go east, look around, and then go straight to the assembly. Mm-hmm. Two birds, one stone.
It is a profound rationalization. He takes a spontaneous, chaotic urge wandering into a dangerous ocean while intoxicated and packages it as an efficient, goal-oriented itinerary.
I have to examine the mechanics of this rationalization. Is the Longwa Assembly actually the goal? Or is Zhong Liquan just providing the necessary bureaucratic cover story so that Zhong Guolao feels comfortable agreeing to a terrible idea?
Oh, it's definitely the latter.
It feels like an incredible psychological manipulation.
Yeah.
He's saying, we aren't just wandering aimlessly. We are taking a scenic detour on our way to an official meeting.
It is absolutely a cover story, and that is why it is so brilliant. It highlights a core Taoist truth. Sometimes, to engage with the chaotic, unstructured aspects of reality, the East Sea, the human mind, requires the illusion of a structured plan.
Wow.
The Longwa Assembly is just an excuse to surrender to the current.
And the excuse works perfectly. The text says, everyone agreed. They dismiss the daughters, turn away from the perfect safety of the Kunlun Mountains, and float eastward into the boundless chaos of the ocean.
Thus beginning the actual journey to the east. The entire banquet was simply the pressurized chamber required to launch them into the unknown.